Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern, von wo aus auch immer Sie uns zuschauen. Ich freue mich sehr, dass Sie da sind und ich begrüße Sie zu dieser Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt, hier aufgezeichnet am Rande der Waldai-Konferenz in Sochi. Sochi, die Riviera Russlands wird sie auch genannt, aber wir sind hier etwas in der Höhe, fast schon in schweizerisch-norwegischen Gefilden, könnte man sagen. Es ist sehr bergig, auf einem Hochplateau. Und ich habe einen Gast bei mir, der sehr interessant ist. Er ist den Lesern der Weltwoche vertraut, denn er hat bei uns schon Artikel publiziert und ich halte ihn für eine der ganz interessanten und auch horizonterweiternden Stimmen in den Debatten, die uns bewegen und die auch hier natürlich zu reden geben. Es geht um die Geopolitik, es geht um den Krieg in der Ukraine. Und Professor Glenn Deason von der Southeastern University in Norwegen, das ist südöstlich von Oslo gelegen, hat er mir erklärt, hat hier ganz substanzielle Beiträge zu leisten. Er gehört zu den vielen Gästen, die hier da sind an dieser Waldai-Konferenz, wo aus unterschiedlichster Perspektive etwas aufs Weltgeschehen geblickt wird. Ich werde jetzt gleich auf Englisch wechseln, damit wir uns verständigen können. Professor Deason, I welcome you in our program. It's great to finally meet you in person after I had the privilege to read your pieces in my newspaper. You wrote a brilliant book about the Ukraine war, which goes a bit against conventional wisdom in this debate, one can say. What were the reactions in the academic establishment in Norway, also probably in the political establishment? Did you get any heat? Was there any controversy after you published your book?
Well, there's obviously controversy because, we kind of have a narrative we have to stick with. But I wouldn't say it would go against conventional wisdom because it's very well cited. So, for example, the narrative now suggests that NATO expansion has nothing to do with it. However, if you go through the literature and the speeches by various presidents, from Bill Clinton to CIA director William Burns, they all kind of confirm that if we expand NATO, what would this entail? Well, we would effectively betray the project of creating a common Europe, and we would revive dividing lines of Europe, would push those dividing lines closer to Russia, and this would reignite the logic of the Cold War. And this is why many American leaders, for example, CIA Director Burns, argued this would likely trigger a war in Ukraine, which he added the Russians didn't want. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't be controversial. I think the reason it becomes controversial is we have a narrative we have to stick with, and that narrative, we tend to defend it against all facts and all evidence from the past. So, but you're right. I think a lot of this has become controversial simply because the facts don't correspond with the narrative which are forced upon us.
Yeah. How do you explain the fact that these obvious facts that you are citing and are quoting, these diplomats from the United States warning that the NATO expansion could trigger a war. How do you explain that these things are not discussed more openly, more commonly in Europe, in the United States? What's wrong here with our discussion culture?
Well, I think in Europe, but wider the West, we have committed ourselves to the idea that we can socially construct our own reality, that perception is reality. So if we just pretend as if we are a force for good and we don't talk about zero-sum geopolitics, then we would create a more peaceful world. I argue the exact opposite, that we ignore the realities of the world and now we're paying the consequences. But it's a very frustrating topic to write on, because I can cite 30 years of literature which makes the point that expanding NATO will trigger conflict. I can point to the area where the West triggered all the evidence that it triggered or supported a coup in Ukraine, but we can't say this. I can point that we sabotage the Minsk agreement, but we can't talk about this. There's overwhelming evidence that the United States and Britain sabotaged the Istanbul agreement at the beginning of the Russian invasion in order to bleed the Russians while fighting with Ukrainians. Overwhelming evidence, but we can't talk about it because if you bring it up, you might legitimize how Russia responded. And mm-hmm. the same goes for Nord Stream. Overwhelming evidence, you know, that this wasn't Russia. Now we admit it was Russia, that it wasn't Russia, but still, when there's no good narratives, what do? We don't talk about it. And I think this is the main problem. We have all this commitment to narratives which we hold on to, even though there's no support, facts supporting it. And when we're countered, we just say Russian propaganda, Russian disinformation, or you're legitimizing Russia's invasion. So it's all about the narrative. All they want to hear is, are you supporting us or the Russians? If you support us, you have to say this is good versus evil and stick to this narrative, no matter how ridiculous it is and no matter how much it undermines our own security.
I talked to a lot of Russians this time, but also the last time when I was here. And you also hear some criticism. They say, well, you know, NATO expansion went too far. That's true. But Putin, he gravely miscalculated. He thought he could have a quick fix, just walk in. The Ukrainians would salute his troops with flowers. But it came out completely different. Putin underestimated the West. And probably the West underestimates Putin still. According to your analysis, but then I will talk about the conference, according to your analysis, what was the biggest mistake or biggest miscalculation of Vladimir Putin in this whole ordeal?
Well, I think there's many mistakes been made. I would say first, I think regarding over the years, I think Russia should have done more to support an autonomous Ukrainian national identity, because again, when you say that we're the same people, it sounds very warm and cuddly. But the thing is, from the other side, especially when they're much smaller than Russia, they might fear that this would undermine their sovereignty. Again, if we're the same, why do we have a separate country? So to defend your sovereignty, there's an incentive to embrace another an opposing identity. And I guess he gave a lot, and this created a reaction, I think, a lot of very ugly, xenophobic, and even fascist political identities emerged, national identities emerged in Ukraine, which, you know, there was a very small minority who supported the Bandera, but now mm-hmm. they're effectively dominating it. And I guess second, the invasion of Russia, I think, of Ukraine was based on two misperceptions. One was Ukrainian national identity. I think they undermined how much the Ukrainians had established an autonomous, independent national identity over the past 30 years. They didn't expect to fight back so much. And a lot of this goes into the same idea that if you want to, that the people who wanted military force, you have to sell it. So you sell it as, well, they will welcome us with flowers, a little bit like the Americans in Iraq. When this doesn't happen, of course, it's obviously didn't happen. And I think the other problem with the invasion was they underestimated the United States. Keep in mind, the U.S., the first time it put in an anti-Russian government was in 2004. It fell away in the next election. They were able to put in a new anti-Russian government in 2014. They build this up, the huge army, for 10 years to fight the Russians. They have strategic documents, everything, that said the goal in Donbas is to bleed the Russians. That's what they said, like Rand Corporation in 2019. So it should have been obvious that once, I knew what the Russians tried to do, they enter Ukraine with a huge military force, and on day one they contact Zelensky and say, listen, you will implement a version of the Minsk agreement. That is, you will restore your autonomy, no more NATO expansion, and in return we will pull our military mm-hmm. back. This was the deal. And I think it should have been obvious that the Americans would not accept this. They had an opportunity. They built a Ukrainian army in the hundreds of thousands, which they could use to fight the Russians. And that's exactly what they did. Indeed, Zelensky himself recognized this in March of 2022, that the Americans would rather not have a quick end to the war, that they would like a long war because this could bleed out the Russians. And he argued even though it would sacrifice Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And I think that this should have been evident because the United States didn't want peace with Russia. They wanted to bleed them. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they were going to use the Ukrainian army as a proxy to fight the Russians. So I think that was another miscalculation.
What will happen next? And what have you learned at this Waldeck conference where we are now about perspectives to end this war? Have you heard anything? You have led a panel just before our conversation. What have you learned? Where do you see the silver lining, the beam of hope, the escape route from this terrible war?
Well, I don't see much of a silver lining, unfortunately. But so far, what we talked mostly about was the concept of Eurasian security, because in history we always had we had rivalry. So the, you know, who's fighting for dominance of Eurasia? So you had in 19th century a British maritime power versus Russian land power. 20th century, Russian land power versus American maritime power. Now I'm arguing that Eurasian security is undergoing huge change because we're now having a multipolar system, and this changes the foundation of Eurasia. That is, for the West, we no longer face a possible hegemon dominating Eurasia. Again, who seriously today assume that Russia either has capability or intentions to dominate Eurasia? And I make the point that even the Chinese, who are now the real power on Eurasia, even they don't have this opportunity. And they seem to maybe be quite comfortable with it, that they want a multipolar system. And this means that they're not trying to prevent the Russians from integrating with India or Iran to have other centers of power. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is positive news also for the West. But that being said, I think Eurasia is going a good direction, but the war in Ukraine, there's no negotiations, there's no one wants to talk, there's no political settlements. So my fear is if we don't have political settlement, they will simply bleed out the Ukrainians, and you will have a very ugly victory in which the Ukrainians will lose a huge amount of troops, which one usually does at the end of a big war, mm-hmm. and also lose a lot of territory to the point that a dysfunctional Ukrainian rump state might actually end to exist. So it's a huge tragedy that this is happening. And if we hadn't criminalized dialogue, negotiations and diplomacy, we might have been able to find a solution. But again, we say often that this is controversial, that we give Putin what he wants. You know, all these words, why diplomacy is a bad thing. But keep in mind, you know, everyone now recognizes Ukraine is losing. And yet, almost 3 years, no European leaders, except for Orban, has wanted to sit down with the Russians, sit down and talk to them. Only talk. Isn't this very irresponsible? It's an absurdity, and it also reflects the ambition to defeat the Russians.
People who are against sitting down with President Putin say, well, Putin has to be stopped. He's this predator. He's the imperialist. He walks in other countries. He wants to change the borders. If we don't stop him in the Ukraine, he will just swallow the next country. He will walk into the Baltics. He will resurrect in a revisionist act the former Soviet Union. What do you counter? What do you say to those voices who say, you cannot sit down, you cannot feed this crocodile, this is appeasement, we have to stop him for good?
What I ask these people, why could we sit down with Mao? Why could we sit down with Stalin? Surely they were much worse. But I think that one also have to unpack this. We always refer to our opponents these days as Hitlers, you know, from yeah, Milosevic, Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, Putin, some refer to Xi Jinping. So why do we call our adversaries Hitlers? And why do we always live in the 1930s? It's because the whole idea is we're in a struggle between good versus evil. And because, you know, if there's a struggle between two sides with competing interests, how do you make peace? You sit down, you have mutual understanding, and you find a compromise. And the Russians have legitimate security concern. However, if you want conflict, you know, resolve this on battlefield, then military solution, then you say this is a Hitler, because Hitler, evil. If you have a settlement, then it's called appeasement. You don't have mutual understanding because, you know, good should not make a compromise with evil. So instead, how do you have peace? Well, you have to defeat them. And this is kind of the dangerous rhetoric we have now. So I think it's an absurdity. Also, one should ask oneself the question, why haven't we What does it mean to defeat Russia, to defeat the world's largest nuclear power? No Western leader has really articulated what this means, because it doesn't work. And this is my point as well. I think we're going to have nuclear weapons raining across, dropping on European cities long before NATO soldiers get to march through Crimea. So it's not going to happen, this victory. Because we have to be honest, Russia sees this as an existential threat. It can't accept to have NATO in Ukraine. And as an existential threat, the Russians will fight to the bitter end, including the use of nuclear weapons. So I think that argument, first of all, is false. And if we allowed open debate and free speech around how this war began, I think that will become more evident as well.
Let's look into the future. What is the world lying ahead of us? Is it the world an absurd version of the Cold War? Are we entering a new kind of bipolar, separated world with the democratic bloc on the one hand and the autocratic bloc on the other hand? Or are we more entering a phase which is, of course, discussed here at Valdai, the multipolar world? One could also say the world of the classical balance of power system, where different players with occasional conflicts try to prevent the house from going up in flames. What is your perception? What have you learned here at this conference where our trip, our journey into the future could lead?
Well, I think this effort to divide the world into liberal democracies versus authoritarian, I think it's a very simplistic and propagandistic way to look at the world. But it's also something common through history. Because in propaganda, you usually want to present the world as good versus evil. And we have various placeholders. So, for example, in the past, in the 19th century, for example, we had civilized world versus barbarians. The Cold War, we have, the capitalism versus communism. After the Cold War, we reinvented dividing lines as liberal democracy versus authoritarianism, to say who should rule and who should be ruled, who is legitimate and who is illegitimate. And I think it's a very unhelpful way. It reduces the complexity of the world and manipulates it to a huge extent. Now, I think I don't see a Cold War scenario either, because it's not two separate blocks. And when the United States is concerned that BRICS, for example, might become an anti-American bloc, they have to also look at the members who are in this bloc. I mean, you have China and India with Pakistan, Iran. I mean, these are hardly allies. In what world would India and Pakistan and China ally against the United States? It wouldn't happen. So it's not an alliance system. It's a system in which the member states seek security with other members to resolve their political differences through economic connectivity. It's not a world where they are dependent on an external enemy. And I think that this is a very important distinction to be made, because it's not an alliance. Indeed, if you listen to the Chinese, they do not want to be a part of an alliance. Alliances, by definition, is country A and B cooperating against country C. I do think they're anti-hegemonic, though. This is quite obvious. But you don't have to destroy or defeat the United States to counter hegemony. All you have to do is to diversify. That is, diversify the technologies you use, the industrial cooperation, various transportation corridors, as we see with the Belt and Road Initiative, use different development banks, different currencies, payment systems. So this doesn't have to be anti-American. It will be anti-hegemonic. But ideally, the way, at least hopefully, the direction it will go would be the ability to accommodate both the EU and the US into this multipolar system. But again, this is the ideal development. We can the United States, as we know, after the Cold War, it formulated a security strategy based on global primacy. This is done very openly. We don't talk about it much, but this essentially means its security is dependent on it dominating every corner of the world. And as the rest of the all these new centers of power emerging, the U.S. can either have peace through defeating all of them, which seemingly they're the direction they're going now, or accept that it is a multipolar system and find its place within it. So my hope, of course, is that the United States goes with the second option.
We are here at this Valdai conference since 20 years. They have this gathering. There are a lot of people from different parts of the world. What is the most interesting thing you have heard? What is the most interesting encounter, whatever you had here, And what do you generally say about this conference? How do you like it? How would you assess it?
Well, I find it interesting because, at least the last 2-3 years, it focused largely on multipolarity and Eurasianism. And this has been my research focus for the past decade. So it's of great interest to me, of course. My main interest is to see how the different regions of the greater Eurasia look towards Eurasian integration. Because if you talk to the Russians, the Chinese, the Indians, the Pakistanis, the Iranians, Koreans, they all have different models, if you will, for greater Eurasia. But I make the point that what they all have in common is the need to harmonize their interests, because even China, the leading state, it can't dictate the terms of Eurasia. If they ignore the Russians can make their life very, very difficult. So they have to harmonize with the Russians. And that's why you see them cooperating in Central Asia. When the Russians saying, listen, we're happy with you being leading economy, but we can't accept you dominating, so we have to diversify. So they're connecting more with India, Iran. The Chinese say, we're comfortable with this. So you see this different dynamic among the different countries. And it's fascinating to see to what extent the pieces fit together. And my greatest wish would be that there would be some more Europeans here and Americans, because we will eventually have to adjust to the realities, which is that there is a multipolar world. And most of the countries in the world now, they want multipolarity, because if you're connected with many centers of power, a multi-vector foreign policy, you can diversify your economy. The result is... Now you can have more independence, because if you only depend on the United States, they can dictate your policy. Now you have all these countries from Turkey, Saudi Arabia, India, across the world. Now they can have more independence, and this is what they want. So it's not about supporting Russia against America, China against America. They don't want this. If you look at the Turks, they're not saying they want to join a Chinese bloc. They want a political sovereignty. That means they want to work with America and China and Russia and the Europeans. And so I think, we should have more representatives from the West, because this world is already here and we're ignoring it at our own peril.
Professor Diessen, many thanks for your remarks. Meine Damen und Herren, sehr interessant. Ja, am Schluss, we ended with a rather optimistic outlook, because, in a world where you have more choice, in a world where nobody wants to take sides, but they want to have alternatives, this would be a perfect definition of democracy. Democracy is the form of government of alternatives. If you have no choice anymore, there is no democracy. And if you have no choice on the world stage, there is no democracy either. So, also nochmal ganz herzlichen Dank, Herr Professor Diessen. Ihnen ganz herzlichen Dank für die Aufmerksamkeit. Und ich darf Ihnen empfehlen, schauen Sie das, lesen Sie die Schriften von Professor Diessen. Glenn Diessen, The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order. Das ist das Buch, das für mich ein Augenöffner war. Er hat großartige auch Empfehlungen von Professor John Mearsheimer, von Jack Matlock, von Jazz Freeman, von ganz bedeutenden auch amerikanischen Theoretikern. Und es ist ein Buch, das in einer sehr klaren Art und Weise die Situation analysiert. Ein Thema konnte mir nicht ansprechen. Er hat dort noch den Begriff der Differenz zwischen Value-Based Order and Rule-Based Order. Es geht ein bisschen in das Kapitel, dass die einen eben ihre Werte so hochsetzen, dass sie glauben, sich nicht mehr an die Regeln halten zu müssen. Und wir Schweizer, we Swiss and we Norwegians, we are the champions and we wish to have a rule-based order, not a value-based order, because, our value is a rule-based order, where not the big ones can force their values on us. Wir Schweizer, wir schätzen das. And we are two Europeans, by the way, not members of the European Union, which is interesting. Norway is the European Economic Zone. Switzerland hasn't even entered this, but there is some distance even here. Also noch einmal ganz herzlichen Dank, Herr Professor Diessen. Ihnen vielen Dank für die Aufmerksamkeit. Das war's aus Waldeyr fürs Erste. Und wir melden uns zurück.